Imran Khan launched his latest long march to force elections after being ousted through a vote of no confidence. He just survived a recent assassination attempt and was left wounded in his leg. Now, people would think that this was an exception to country's politics. It's not the norm to have assassination attempts. If you remember, back in 2009, Benazir Bhutto was similarly shot when she was carrying out rallies. Pakistan is this enigma in South Asia, which is always teetering on the verge of collapse, but it is a nation that is needed by the global powers in order to secure their interests. Today, we want to talk about everything Pakistan and how to make sense of this country, which is so important in geopolitics. We've got Adnan Khan, the founder of Geopolity, to unravel it all for us. How are you keeping, Adnan?
I'm good, Yusuf. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Now, Pakistan is something that I actually don't know much about. It's not my country of origin. So forgive me if I ask very basic questions. I think the first thing is, why is Pakistan so unstable?
Pakistan is unstable for a couple of very simple reasons, and that is because the politicians, the rulers, the ruling elite, they are really in power to fulfill their own agendas and their own interests. They're not really there to develop the nation, to take the nation forward. So as a result, you have a lot of competition between different clans, different dynasties, different factions. And that's really what causes regular instability in the country. So you mentioned Imran Khan, there was an assassination attempt on his life. You're right, that's not the first time. We saw the same thing happen with Benazir Bhutto. We've had assassinated politicians and presidents and prime ministers in the past. We've had a prime minister who was hung in Pakistan's history. You've had the army ruled the country for half of its life. So this is Pakistan's politics. It's very unstable. There is no longevity. As far as I can remember, I think only one government in Pakistan's history has completed its term and then passed over to another elected government who took over. So in what, 75 years of Pakistan's history, it's only happened once. So all governments in Pakistan's history never completed their term because they were either overthrown or the army did a coup. And this is the fundamental reason why Pakistan's politics is so unstable.
So let me just hone in on that point. Why have so many civilian rulers failed to finish their terms?
So multiple reasons for this. Half of cases are because the army intervened. They did a coup, and the army intervened for various reasons, due to corruption, due to incompetence, due to foreign interference. On the other occasion, I mean, the 1990s is described as Pakistan's era of democracy. You just had a decade of military rule. You had the rise of Benazir Bhutto at the end of the 80s. And throughout the 90s, you saw Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif were in power. Now, in this decade, none of them completed their term. Both of them were removed due to corruption charges. So what you tend to find is Pakistan's politics, the civilian politics, is dominated by dynasties, is dominated by opportunists, is dominated by clans, and all of them really are competing with each other to make it to the top of Pakistan and loot and plunder the nation. So even if you look at everyone that supported Imran Khan into power, it was them who turned against him in the end, and that led to a vote of no confidence. How can you have a vote of no confidence in parliament when your party has the most MPs? So this, unfortunately, is the reality of Pakistan's politics.
Now, you mentioned Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif. They were removed because of corruption charges. Pakistan, it does regularly come up at the top in corruption indexes. What makes it such a corrupt country?
So what makes it so corrupt is Pakistan's politics is not based on ideology or a program. It's based on kinship and patronage. So what that means is, to get to power, rally supporters, you make promises to them, they help you get to power, and then once you're in power, you have to pay them back, you have to take care of them. So how can the nation move forward when what you're doing is using state resources, government resources, public resources for your own ends? And that's why it's not surprising Pakistan always comes top or second, interchangeably with Nigeria, funny enough, in the corruption index. Unfortunately, corruption is a way of life in Pakistan. So Nawaz Sharif's been overthrown 3 times and he's still not giving up. He still wants to be in power. So unfortunately, the system is riddled with corruption. And that's why, despite the change of many faces, corruption remains a consistent feature of Pakistan's politics.
Let's look at Pakistan's history. So obviously we had the partition and it led to India and Pakistan, but the relationship wasn't very friendly. They actually hate each other a lot. What's the reason for that?
So Pakistan and India, the best way to view it is they were in a marriage for 1,000 years and they had a very messy divorce in 1947. And as a result, they are now enemies. They hate each other. And India kept some of the settlement, i.e. Kashmir. And as a result, they've always had a very difficult relationship after that. In the case of Pakistan, the army has built a narrative that India is the enemy. India is much larger than Pakistan, has more resources. So only the army can protect Pakistan against India. As a result, over the years, the army came to play a central role in Pakistan's national security, in Pakistan's politics, in Pakistan's foreign policy. Whether it's real or perceived, the threat from India is the justification for the army to take anywhere between 25 to 45% of Pakistan's budget. Significant resources of Pakistan go to the army because only they can defend against India. So yeah, in origin, there was a messy divorce. And since then, the Pakistani army has built a whole narrative that they are the only institution that can defend Pakistan against India. So as a result, you grow up in Pakistan, you go to school, the culture, the political medium is all very, very anti-Indian because of this.
Now, you brought up the army. I do want to talk about the army in a little while. But first of all, from my reading, it seemed that Pakistan wanted to be separate to India because it wanted to establish Islam. Is Pakistan an Islamic state?
So Pakistan's separation, I mean, that's probably a whole podcast on its own, because the creation of Pakistan is something that really came right at the end. In fact, from the British perspective, partition was a decision made. I mean, Pakistan was created August 1947. In May, the British plan was never partitioned. In May 1947, the British plan was you have a confederation with India and Pakistan, one nation, Muslims and Hindus living together. Nevertheless, in the end, the British made the decision to partition due to their own geopolitical and strategic interests. Now, as far as the Muslims were concerned, the narrative amongst them was we can't really live with Hindus. This was the argument at the end Muhammad Ali-Jinnah advocated. We have different beliefs, we have different value systems. Therefore, we need our own nation where we as Muslims can practice our faith freely the way we want. So as far as the people were concerned, Pakistan was created in the name of Islam. It was created for us because we had our own values. So as far as the people are concerned, Pakistan was created in the name of Islam. Unfortunately, on Pakistan's establishment, what you find from then up until today, really lip service has largely been played to implementing Islam. So what you find, there are bits and bobs of Islam that are applied, but on the core policies, foreign policy, on the legal system, on the financial system, what you find is Islam is not the basis in these areas. In fact, sometimes Islam is thrown in, but on the whole, it's national interest, it's nationalism that drives a lot of these areas. So in Pakistan, because Friday is a national holiday, because Eid is a national holiday, because the call to prayer, the Azan, is done publicly, these are all Islamic things. So many people feel they are living in some element of an Islamic state because these things are there. But you find the politicians, they are not looking at Islam when it comes to their relationship with the world. They are not looking at Islam when they're looking at developing the country. In Pakistan, you have Sharia courts, you have secular courts side by side together. These are not really indicators of an Islamic state. So the people sacrificed a lot. They moved from mainland India to come to this nation called Pakistan, which was created in the name of Islam. And this dream and this vision, it still hasn't been achieved yet.
Now, I'm guessing from this partition, Kashmir was basically the collateral.
Yeah, so Kashmir, British, when they ruled over combined India, as we know it at the time, they directly ruled over half of India, and the other half, they indirectly ruled, and they were ruled by Nawabs, they were ruled by chiefs, they were ruled by clans, and they effectively were semi-autonomous. Kashmir was one of those areas. It was ruled by a Hindu Maharaja. So the British areas that they directly ruled at partition, whatever the majority population was, they would go in that direction. So the majority population was Muslim, they would go to Pakistan. If it was Hindu, it would go to India. You had a bit of a unique scenario in Kashmir because you had a Hindu ruler over a majority Muslim population. So in practice, it should have really gone to Pakistan. But due to Kashmir's strategic location, due to the fact that the waters of the north of India and Pakistan come through the Himalayas via Kashmir, India didn't really want to lose that territory. So they cut a deal with the Maharaja, who effectively moved to India and surrendered Kashmir to them. And that is what led to the first war in Kashmir in 1948. And we've had subsequent wars after that. What you do find is successive Pakistani rulers in the army, they raise the issue of Kashmir when they need it. And on other occasions, they leave the issue of Kashmir when they don't really want to talk about it. Probably the most major change that happened is up until Musharraf in 1999, Pakistan's policy was there's no negotiation and we will maintain a low intensity struggle against India to bleed it to death in Kashmir. So that's why Pakistan historically supported many jihadi groups, many mujahideen to go in Kashmir and make it very difficult for India to occupy it. Once Musharraf came to power in 1999, once the war on terror kicked off in 2001, the Musharraf regime turned their back on the jihadi group. They banned them, they chased the leaders out of the country, and they imprisoned many others as well. So since then, effectively, Kashmir has been frozen. Pakistan talks about it, but it doesn't actually do anything about it. Nothing obviously going on at the UN. And a couple of years ago, the Indian side of Kashmir has now been fully integrated into India. So unfortunately, today the scenario is successive Pakistani rulers talk about Kashmir. They give a lot of rhetoric because Kashmir matters to the Pakistani public, but physically they've effectively surrendered it. They're not really engaging in any actions to take back Kashmir.
Now, another big event in Pakistan's history was the independence of Bangladesh, which separated in 1971. What was the backdrop of that and what was the main reason why they did separate?
Okay, so at partition, the Muslim majority areas of India were the Bengal area and what became Pakistan. So you had East and West Pakistan that were technically one country, divided by what, 1,000 miles of northern India. So that already potentially made it quite difficult to rule over. It wasn't contiguous land which was linked together. In Bengal, obviously, culturally, ethnically, you had Bengali Muslims there. That's who they were from the area. They had their language. They had their own history. And the Muslims in West Pakistan, they were broken down into various languages and ethnicities. So although Pakistan exists as one nation, really, Punjab, Sindh, Balochistan, they have their own languages. And even within them, they've got their own culture and languages. So really, what happened was is the population in Bangladesh was actually slightly more than the total population in West Pakistan. As elections were going on, the Muslims in East Pakistan realized if they support one party, they would become a majority in combined Pakistan, so they would be allowed to form the government. Problem is, the politicians like Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto, the army general Ayub Khan, they refused to allow the Muslims from East Pakistan to completely form the government for both territories. And a lot of this comes down to, well, they look down upon the Muslims in East Pakistan. Ayub Khan, in his own biography, he spoke about when he was put into position in Bangladesh before the creation of Pakistan. And he talks about what he thinks of the Muslims in that region. And, you know, it's probably not great to repeat here, but they look down upon them. They look down upon them culturally. And so these things really bred this mentality amongst the Muslims in Bengal that how can we live with these people when they look down upon us? So after 1947, these issues really started to grow. It didn't help when the official language for Pakistan was made into Urdu. It didn't take into account the other languages. And by the time the 60s, 1960s was coming to an end, really the Muslims in East Pakistan had really mobilized and organized and come to the conclusion that they need to really have their own state. They can't live with these people in West Pakistan who really look down upon them. Then I think it came to a head in 1968. There was an election where the Mujibur Rahman's party won the majority. So they had the right to form the government for combined Pakistan. And that wasn't allowed because Zulfikar Ali Bhutto in Sindh and then the army in Punjab, they said, well, unless you don't win a province in West Pakistan, you can't form a government. And that really began the final catalyst. The army was deployed in East Pakistan because there was rebellion on the street. And then eventually this led to, you know, an Indian intervention as well. They supported the rebel movement in East Pakistan. And then I think by 1971, end of 1970, East Pakistan has separated and it became Bangladesh. Now, the army in Pakistan, even today, they actually accept that they see the separation of East Pakistan as a big loss. And they, a lot of them actually accept that we treated the Muslims there really, really badly. They see it as a big loss that they lost their own territory. And especially they lost it to India, that made it even far worse. So there is an acceptance within the army that it was wrong what they did. And in fact, it was their actions which actually led to the separation of East Pakistan in the end.
Of Bangladesh, we see the army very prominent in there. So you mentioned Ayub Khan. And you find the army is very prominent throughout the whole history of Pakistan. How did the army manage to get into such a key position within the country where it's actually making decisions in politics?
Well, quite simply, Yusuf, the founders of Pakistan, the first generation of leaders of Pakistan, were in between somewhere of incompetent and mediocre. So you've got a new country that's been created. There's no plan, there's no strategy on how they're going to deal with mass migration from India. There was no plans on how they're going to develop the economy. So as a result, the troubles in the creation of Pakistan started very, very quickly. This was different to Nehru and Gandhi, who established the Congress Party. And they had plans, they had five-year plans. They wanted to establish a country on Soviet lines. And they had access to a lot more raw materials as well. In the case of Pakistan, you find Muhammad Ali Jinnah was fighting for so long for an independent nation. The day he got the independent nation, there was no plan or strategy. Millions of people died in the partition shifting from India to Pakistan. There was no plan, there was no humanitarian effort, there was nothing in place. So as a result, the army really was the only institution that was organized. It was obviously organized by the British military. It had access to resources. So by, I think, 1958, the army did a coup. But by that point, the politicians had run the country into the ground anyway. And then since then, most civilian politicians have usually been from dynastic families. And that brought its own problems into the country as well. So the army has regularly intervened. Now, the army ruled the period they have been in power. It hasn't really been too different to the civilian era. So while civilian rule in Pakistan usually consists of corruption, army rule usually starts off really, really good because the situation is really, really bad. And then it usually descends into the army general becoming effectively a dictator and clamping down on rebellion or any criticism of the regime. So although the army has been in power for half of Pakistan's history, it's not really fared any better in terms of developing the nation or improving the nation.
Now, if we look at Pakistan's economy, Pakistan is in a lot of debts. It seems like every single government that comes in, all they do is put the country in more debt. How is Pakistan ever going to actually come out of this economic problem that they're in?
Well, Pakistan's debt, if you actually look at it, their first IMF loan, I think, was 1958. And since then, they've had 24 different programs of the IMF. And the country's not improved one bit. So taking more loans is not going to change anything. In fact, all the loans that have been taken have not improved Pakistan. In fact, I would question, where has the loans even gone? From the looks of it, it's gone into the pockets of the rulers, and the IMF still give even more money. So the debt hasn't benefited the country at all. It's easy for the rulers of Pakistan to take international debt because they won't be the ones repaying it back. They'll be long gone. Future generations will have to pay it back. And this probably brings us to a broader issue of Pakistan. Pakistan's economy is not fit for purpose. There's no long-term plan, long-term strategy. All the rulers have not even attempted to develop the economy. They're too busy trying to loot the country or plunder the nation for their own objective. The army effectively is a corporation in itself. It is a big drain on Pakistan's resources and it hides behind India to justify this. So for most people, the economy doesn't even really work for them. So that's why, because Pakistan relies on foreign imports of oil, because it relies on certain raw materials from abroad, it doesn't even have sufficient dollars really to pay for these. And this is where these loans come in. So unfortunately, it's become like a spiraling circle where rather than thinking outside the box and trying something new, successive Pakistani rulers just try the same policies again and again and again. Imran Khan lambasted the previous regime for years of going to the IMF. He used to say, how embarrassing is this that we keep going to the IMF to beg them for money? It took Imran Khan only 4 months when he came into power to go with the same begging bowl to the IMF. So despite all his talk about tsunami of change, despite all this talk of ending corruption and establishing a new way in the country, really the 3 years, 7 months Imran Khan was in power, it was really a continuation of the same. And unfortunately, this is why all you hear from Pakistan is inflation is going through the roof, GDP is shrinking, corruption, international debt, deficits. These are common because the economy has been running to the ground by successive rulers.
Now, even with that in mind, alongside all the corruption in Pakistan, it's still a very key nation in the world. I mean, if we look back at the war on terror, it was a key US ally. How would you describe Pakistan in the context of geopolitics today? Is it still very much a US ally as it was in the war on terror, or do you find that it's actually moving, or do you find it's actually growing closer to China?
So Pakistan was reaching out to America even before the creation, even before partition. What Pakistan's rulers realized is all the main industry in India, all the military equipment is in mainland India. And India and Pakistan got very little of India's assets. It got very little of the military equipment. So as a result, Pakistan emerged from a very weak position. So already Muhammad Ali Jinnah and the people around him, they were already reaching out to America. They could see America as the next power. They could see that their view was that aligning with America, joining America's Cold War, that is the shortest and quickest way for us to develop economically and militarily. That's what they did. The only problem was America wanted, for its Cold War, in the South Asia, it wanted India as its ally. India was the bigger country. India was much more bigger, and it could basically be a counterweight to China and the Soviet Union.
I guess at that time, that would be the most sensible decision. As in, what other option would Pakistan have had?
It could be. Unfortunately, what you find with people like Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan, and the people around him, there wasn't really any long-term thinking. I mean, it's probably a podcast in itself, but the emergence of Pakistan, there's a lot still that's been left to... There's still a lot of issues in terms of partition, the negotiations that happened. The main problem was there was actually no plan the day after partition. There was actually no strategy, and that's why Pakistan fell into so many significant issues. In India, they were already talking about what their plan actually was. So the easiest thing for them was that America is probably the quickest and shortest route. Now, America actually didn't see Pakistan like that. America actually saw India as a country it wanted to ally with. But India wanted to remain neutral. India didn't want to be on the Russian side or the American side. So as a result, America had to settle with Pakistan in the end. And then you see throughout the 50s, many military agreements were made with Pakistan. Pakistan gave America air bases in the country, and a lot of economic and military aid did flow in Pakistan. But what America realized is a lot of this military equipment America's given to Pakistan, Pakistan was eyeing this military equipment to use against India. So they obviously went to war in 1965. And this is not what America saw as its main relationship with Pakistan. It didn't want Pakistan to be fighting in India with its equipment. It wanted Pakistan to use the equipment in the Cold War against the Soviet Union and the Communist bloc. But Pakistan saw that the best way to stand up against India was to work with America, achieve their interests, and then use that economic aid and military aid. And that is what caused the original tension in relationship between the two. So since then, what you find is whenever America goes to war in Eurasia, it needs Pakistan, it needs Pakistan's influence in Afghanistan, and it gets the support from Pakistan because Pakistan thinks they get a lot of military equipment. And then very quickly, Pakistan drags its feet, it starts using equipment for other purposes, and then you see the criticism come from America to the point where Pakistan has now become the battered wife in this relationship. There is a debate, what has actually Pakistan got out of this relationship with America? America used Pakistan during the Cold War. America used Pakistan during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. America used Pakistan for its war on terror invasion of Afghanistan. And all it does today is it criticizes Pakistan. It criticizes the army. It says, you know, you're terrorists, you're double playing us. And all that time, Pakistan's got into more debt. it hasn't really developed, and the situation of your average person has got far worse. So yeah, Pakistan is the battered partner in this relationship, and in, you know, these sort of relationships where you're abused, you can't see any way out. And that's why again and again, Pakistan's rulers, be they civilian elites or the army, they see working with America as the only way to move forward. They literally don't think outside that context. And this is probably where China becomes quite interesting, because what you find is China is offering economics, is offering finance, is building the Pakistan-China economic corridor. And the country's rulers are very happy with this, but it's bringing the money into the country. However, strategically, Pakistan has done nothing with China. China and Pakistan's relationship, it goes back to one thing, which is India. That is the whole basis of the relationship. Up until the 1960s, Pakistan viewed China as part of the communist bloc, and Pakistan was with America in the Cold War. The moment India and China went to war in 1961, and because they both had a common enemy, India and China opened up relations. Now, Pakistan has never gone to war with India when China is at war with India. When Pakistan moves, when China's at war with India, then you could say China and Pakistan are aligned now. But that has never happened. For the last few years, in the northern Himalayan areas, China and India have effectively been at war. Not once has Pakistan moved on Kashmir during this period. So what all this shows you is there's a commercial economic relationship with China, but it doesn't go beyond that. The strategic relationship, that's with America. And in that relationship, Pakistan is the abused partner.
Now, that does make a lot of sense. Going back to the point that you made about America and the criticisms that come from America, I guess one of the criticisms, whether it's true or not, maybe you can shed some light. Pakistan is being accused constantly of supporting terrorism. Is that really the case?
So as the saying goes, one man's terrorism is another man's freedom fighter. What Pakistan has done over the years, in origin, this whole term terrorism, it comes from the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the Mujahideen that were trained and armed and funded. And these people then went on to go on and fight in Kashmir and other conflicts. And over time in the 90s, they came to be termed as terrorists. So in origin, America had no problem. In fact, America supported the arming and training of the Mujahideen against the Soviet Union. So what you find is today it's convenient to use this as a stick against Pakistan. So they do it. But 30, 40 years ago, these were freedom fighters. These were the Taliban, when they were sitting in the White House in the 1990s, they were termed by the president at the time as similar to America's founding father. They were fighting a liberation struggle. So this is really a propaganda. At the end of the day, America supported groups who were fighting in Syria. America has a long history of supporting groups who fight around the world. They're not called terrorists. They're called American-supported groups. They're called a faction. They're not called terrorists. But how is that any different to what Pakistan does? So yeah, Pakistan has its interests. It's been supporting Mujahideen in the past. It's been supporting non-state actors like every other nation does in the world. But when Pakistan does it, it's terrorism. But when America does it, it's not terrorism. It's called something else.
Which is a good point that you make. I guess the question is, why did Pakistan support the Mujahideen and ultimately then the Taliban? What's the history of this relationship, and where does Pakistan benefit in this?
So Pakistan has a border with Afghanistan. It's a border in the mountains, so in practice it doesn't really exist. So Pakistan has always been involved in some form or shape in Afghanistan. India has always tried to get a foot into Afghanistan, so that added to Pakistan viewing India from a strategic perspective. So when the Soviet Union invaded, this was the Soviet Union expanding into South Asia. So Pakistan, as a result, it organized the defense of South Asia through funding the Mujahideen, organizing the Mujahideen, and with Pakistan army soldiers fighting alongside the Mujahideen against the Soviet Union. So when the Soviet Union was defeated, effectively, 1987 onwards, a civil war really raged in Afghanistan from about the end of the 80s up until 1994. So in 1994, obviously there's lots of instability in the country, different warlords and different factions who fought alongside each other against the Soviet Union. They're now fighting each other. So the Pakistan, to bring stability, it reached out to the Talibs students who came known as the Taliban, and it supported and funded them. And they, by 1996, they formed the government by defeating most of the other groups in the country. Once the Taliban took power, they actually ran the country quite separately to Pakistan. Pakistan was just happy. It's got a friendly government in Afghanistan. They're going to work on stability. there's no instability anymore because there's now one government. And that's the relationship Pakistan has had. So even during the war on terror, despite Pakistan's official policy being we are with America, many army officials and many other people, they supported the Taliban in their war against the American invasion. Many tribes and tribal leaders in the northern areas of Pakistan, they supported the Taliban in Afghanistan against America's invasion. So what this comes down to, Yusuf, is it was Pakistan's interests, coupled with these are Muslims, these are brothers, and that's how the people of Pakistan have always viewed their relationship with Afghanistan and the Taliban.
Now, we've discussed a number of different points, a whole host of problems with Pakistan. Now, many people believed Imran Khan was the guy that was going to take them out of this mess. He was the savior of the nation. But obviously, he didn't fare very well. Could you kind of give us some more information about his time in power? What went wrong?
Okay, yeah, so you're absolutely right. Imran Khan rose to... I mean, he's been around in politics since the 1990s. But really, from 2013 onwards, he really rose to prominence. He led a struggle against the government at the time. And really, in the 2010-2013, many people had lost hope in Pakistan. You'd had army rule for about 10 years. Then you had Zardari takeover. Then you had Nawaz Sharif takeover. And they had just run the country into the ground. Imran Khan led a whole movement, or tsunami as he likes to call it, that he's the change candidate. He cares about Pakistan. And if people get behind him, he will bring the change that people want. Now, this isn't new. Every leader of Pakistan uses the same rhetoric. The difference with Imran Khan is he's from a completely different background to the usual political class and the rulers of Pakistan. So he's not from a dynastic family. He's not from a corrupt business background. He was a cricketer that won the World Cup for Pakistan in 1992. So he had that credibility. And since then, he got involved in politics and he set up a cancer hospital. So because of that, he got wide support because he's from a clean background. Unfortunately, what you find is once he came to power, and he was in power for 3 years, 7 months, so he completed over 70% of his term, what you find is the usual problems and the usual issues rose again. What you find again is if you come to power, you don't have total control. The army runs the key parts of Pakistan. Imran Khan, despite making grand promises, he found that was the case as well. The main problem is in actual ruling, Imran Khan turned out to be quite incompetent, very similar to the previous rulers. So you find the economy was growing about 5% prior to Imran Khan coming into power. Then under him, it halved. Inflation was about 5% and it very quickly rose to double digits under Imran Khan. All of this was before COVID. COVID just made this already bad situation even worse. And even with COVID, Imran Khan flipped and flopped. So when he originally said there may be a lockdown, the ulama came out and said, don't you dare do a lockdown. It's Ramadan, we want to pray in the mosque. Then he said there won't be a lockdown. Then he said there would be a lockdown. Then he changed his mind. Then he said there'd be a smart lockdown. And then on one particular day, he said there's going to be no lockdown. And by the evening, the army has started the lockdown anyway. So really, and then if I am correct, in total, under his 3 years, 7 months, he borrowed the most in any government in Pakistan's history. He borrowed $39 billion. So literally, Imran Khan actually created world record in all the wrong ways in Pakistan. However, once Imran Khan was ousted, and it was easy to oust him because the economy had been running to the ground. Once he'd been ousted, he then launched a whole movement. And his key argument is I've been overthrown by foreign powers, namely America. So he used the anti-American rhetoric, which will always get you support in Pakistan. And then secondly, that these corrupt people, they're back in power. So because he was overthrown, he's gained a lot of sympathy from the people. In fact, if the person who benefited the most from his ouster is Imran Khan himself. He's more popular today. He has more sympathy of the people today. In fact, the army actually doesn't know how to deal with his popularity. In the past, the army is very good at controlling the rise and fall of individuals. Imran Khan has his own supporter base, and the head of the army has had a big problem in actually dealing with this. And in fact, Imran Khan's fall, aside from all the economic issues, it actually began when he fell out with the head of the army, General Bajwa. And this was over the appointment of a number of army officials and the head of the ISI. Because Imran Khan dragged his feet on this, that was a step too far for the army general. And at that point, the army general reached out to the Sharif family in the UK. And that's when the whole chain started, the chain of events that eventually led to his ouster. So what you find, the army actually already started to feel a bit embarrassed with Imran Khan because the economy was doing so bad. And then him getting in the way of army appointments was the final straw. So that's really the background to what's going on. And in some ways, it's not that different to the history of Pakistan. The only difference here is Imran Khan is in a relatively strong position. Nawaz Sharif has been overthrown in the past. He wasn't in a strong position. Imran Khan has got the sympathy of the people, and people have forgotten what happened for 3 years, 7 months when he was in power. They just see we don't want corrupt people, and Imran Khan's ouster was a foreign conspiracy, and, you know, we don't want any foreign interference in the country.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it seems like it's a repetitive cycle with Pakistan. Just one last question for you, Adnan. Where do you see Pakistan going into the future? Do you think that they will be able to get out of the mess that they're currently in?
So there's actually some interesting trends evolving in Pakistan. Firstly, Pakistan's population at the moment is just over 200 million, and the expectation is it's only going to grow. And the majority of Pakistan's population is very young. So with a dysfunctional economy, with an economy that doesn't meet the needs of the people, you've got a massive problem building. This problem already exists in much of the Arab world, where you've got about a million plus people entering the workforce every year, looking for jobs that don't exist. As your population increases, you need to house them, you've got to build infrastructure, you've got to educate them, you need healthcare. There is no plans whatsoever for the long term on how the army or how successive regimes plan to actually deal with this. So really, this is a ticking time bomb. And what you find really is the army leadership is the only institution upholding the system of Pakistan. This corrupt system that's dysfunctional, that really doesn't serve the people. Actually, I think things will come to a head. I think we're coming to a point now where people are realizing that we've had so many different faces, but the situation of the average person has got far worse. So you need more systemic and more fundamental change in the country. Beyond Pakistan, you've got obviously some interesting developments. You've got the rise of China. You've got America, who last year left very embarrassingly from Afghanistan. You've got Russia as well. This region, once again, is becoming the geopolitical pivot, the important region in the world. And that means Pakistan will have to probably take a side or take an independent course. But the important thing is Pakistan will be right in the middle of the future of global competition. It's been in during the Soviet Union, it was there. The Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, Pakistan was central. And with China and America, Pakistan will also play a critical role as well. The decision Pakistan has to make, will you take a side and once again be an American lackey or become a Chinese lackey, or will you actually forge an independent course and actually take advantage of these developments? And that's probably a question Pakistan's elite and Pakistan as a people really need to answer.
Thank you for your time today, Adnan. It was a very interesting discussion. If you want to learn more about the issues we've raised today, please check out the website, www.thegeopolicy.com. You can also learn more on other issues by accessing our website, where you'll find comprehensive insights. Thank you for listening.